Welcome to our second session of Polarization and the Unmaking of America with Dr. Derek Woodard Lehman from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Today's topic is social media and social conflict decelerating polarization. And now Derek will open with prayer.
Good morning. Since it is Father's Day, I will pray the short prayer I pray with my two little boys who are not so little. One is as tall as I am and taller than his mother. They're now in their teenage years, and the older one kind of rolls his eyes and, you know, submits to the morning prayer. The younger one still kind of like it, but please pray with me. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. Good morning again. And if you were here last week, welcome back. If you're new and here for the first time, welcome. In a minute, we'll do a brief recap to catch up in case you weren't here last time or weren't able to view the video online. The topic for this Westminster series, as Sarah just said, is polarization and the unmaking of America. Last week, we focused on understanding polarization. What is it? Why is it? How does it work? This week, we'll focus on decelerating polarization. How do we put the brakes on what I think most of us feel are negative trends and attitudes and feelings in our society and public life? And next week, in conclusion, we'll talk about responding to polarization. How do we, as Christians and citizens, and as good neighbors, both in the ordinary sense of being a decent person and in the extraordinary Christian sense of being charitable and loving, how do we respond when everyone seems so bloody mad about everything? As I said last week, we'll get deeper into theological reflection today and really plunge into some serious theological work next week. We're kind of building to that theological conclusion. But let's start with a brief review. So last week, we just introduced the idea of polarization itself and drew an important distinction. To say that things are polarized, most basically, is to say that they're opposite. They exist on different ends of a spectrum, in different social or intellectual or political space. And most importantly, to say that things are polarized is to say that in some way and to some degree, they stand in opposition. They're not just apart from each other, they are against each other. We also observe that when it comes to politics, social issues, and public opinion, the most obvious symptom of polarization is that public opinion has become an all caps tweet storm. Public debate sounds like a shouting match, a knockdown, drag out slugfest. With respect to politics, it seems less susceptible to compromise and cooperation. We're not just fighting electoral battles or policy wars, we're in an all-out culture war. And we also identified a crucial distinction within polarization. Polarization is not only, or even primarily, the fact that we disagree about issues, because issues are floating. We can disagree about this one, but agree about that one. Issue polarization is a little more fluid and dynamic, depending on which issues are involved. So issue polarization is not the primary problem, which is not to say it's not a problem at all. We said it's rather identity polarization that is more troubling. We disagree not only about this thing or that, we disagree about who we are and who counts as we. And more importantly, who counts as them in us and them dynamics. We laid out these various identity characteristics on a slide and said that they have particular salience in our historical, social, and political context. The significance and salience of these characteristics is consistent across different survey and research methodologies, across place and time, and across different researchers, which is to say they're pretty reliably correlated. These characteristics have coalesced, we might even say they've consolidated, in a way that we call stacking. So it's not that you have this and that and the other characteristic that sort of float loosely in your identity. They sort of nest inside each other like those Russian Matryoshka dolls. These characteristics have become synonymous with one another, so much so that they're predictive. If we know one or more of these characteristics about you, we can pretty reliably predict the other ones, which is to say that our differences have become settled. There's less wiggle room, there's less room for change, growth. And most importantly, they've consolidated under our broadly partisan identities: liberal, progressive, conservative, traditionalist, Republican, Democrat, and so on and so forth. So much so that we regard people who are our political other much differently than even we did just a few decades ago. Prior to the 80s, Americans regarded members of the other party as mostly trustworthy and moderately favorable. Since the 80s, those trusting feelings about people who think differently, who vote differently, who believe differently than us, have been steadily declining into negative territory. So much so that at this point in our public life, over 40% of us thinks that the other side of the aisle is not just someone with whom we disagree, but we regard them as a threat to American public life. They're not just opponents, as we said last week, they are enemies. So much so that people now regard mixed political marriage more unfavorably than mixed religious marriage. Even evangelical Christians, who we tend to think of as very religious, very insular in their religiosity, even evangelical Christians would rather that their children marry someone of a different faith or no faith in the same party, rather than someone in the same faith, but with a different voting card, which is rather remarkable. Which all of this is to say that our partisan identities have been what we subsumed most of our other identities into. And we illustrated that with this little diagram where our other identities now have become stacked and fitted into our partisan identities. And it's our partisan identities that coordinate and consolidate these other attributes, including our faith, whether we have faith or don't, which particular faith we have, whether we're Christian, Jew, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, et cetera. And if we're Christians, which particular denominational tradition we fall into. Sociologists call these our mega identities. These are the meta identities that sort of govern the other ones. And it's these mega identities that drive identity polarization, an issue in a phenomenon that sociologists and political theorists call negative partisanship. As Sarah said last week when she introduced me, I did some of my graduate work at Duke University, which has not only a world-class theology program, but a championship-winning basketball program. Duke plays its home games in Cameron Indoor Stadium, where I must confess I spent probably more time than I should in graduate school. And the student section in Cameron is referred to as the Cameron Crazies due to the fervor and passion with which they support the Blue Devils. You can see that illustrated well here in a game versus our arch rivals, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Tar Heels, just a few miles down Tobacco Road. Go to hell, Carolina, go to hell. This rivalry ranks among the greatest in sports. It's up there with Yankees, Red Sox, Lakers, Celtics, and so on and so forth. The definitive history of the rivalry between Duke and North Carolina is a book called To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, which is a remarkable title. And some editor was very clever to choose it because it makes you want to pull the book off the shelf. What that provocative title captures and reveals is the intensity and animosity of, in this case, a sporting rivalry. Yes, I want my Blue Devils to win, but I also want the Tar Heels to lose. So much so that even when Duke has a down year and we're not doing very well, I take great, and some might even say perverse pleasure, if Carolina is doing worse. So it's not just that I like my guys. Oops. I hate those guys in the sports sense. Not really, you know, in real life. I work with some Carolina people and they're perfectly lovely. Even so, that sentiment, that thought, that feeling that even if we're losing, it doesn't matter if they're losing worse, is what political scientists call negative partisanship. It's not just that we're positively and affirmatively for our guys. We're negatively against those guys, however we're defining these guys and those guys. Negative partisanship was on full display in the 2016 presidential election. Just days before voting, both candidates had majority unfavorable public opinion, even among their supporters. Neither side of the aisle liked either of the candidates. In fact, we were pretty negatively disposed towards both of them. Even on election day, when voters left, the exit polls showed the same thing. Who'd you vote for? Hillary. Who'd you vote for? Donald. Well, what do you think about that? 40% of the people who had just voted for their candidates more or less said they didn't like the candidate for whom they just voted. But again, it was more important to vote for someone you don't like who's on your team than to concede or vote for someone who might be on the other team. And this aspect of polarization, this negative partisanship, is what I think is most dangerous to both our citizenship and our discipleship. It makes us unlikely to be good neighbors, either in the ordinary sense of American decency, you know, what we see in Norman Rockwell paintings of idyllic small town community life of everybody going along and getting along, or in the more extraordinary Christian sense of charity, compassion, and service. If we're honest, in this day and age, in our time and place, the parable of the Good Samaritan illustrated here in this triptych would probably go something more like this. A traveler went down a road through a dodgy neighborhood or out in the backwoods where there's no one around, where bandits are known to be. They were set upon, beaten, and robbed. Others passed by and looked down and did nothing, but some stopped by. And unlike the parable in the Bible, rather than coming to the aid of the man or the person beaten, robbed, and left for dead, they took selfies and posted to social media. Hashtag stay woke. Hashtag own the libs. We're more likely to look upon the pain, failure, and catastrophe of our others with glee. The way I feel about looking at ESPN and seeing that Carolina lost. Yes, those guys lost. And that's not good for us in any way, shape, or form. And that brings us to our topic for today, social media and social conflict, decelerating polarization. In the background of the slide, you can probably see there are tiled icons of various social media. There's a stylized version of the Facebook F as a smoking gun. And there are post-it notes about alternative facts, fake news, and those sorts of things. Now, a brief point of order before we go further, I'll be talking a lot about social media, but what I say applies to traditional media as well. Not only to those that social scientists refer to as extremely online, but those of us who still read physical newspapers and magazines and who tune in to the evening news or daytime political opinion broadcasting. So I'm talking a lot about social media, but the dynamics are more or less the same for traditional legacy media. Last week, we noted a paradox about our media ecosystem. On the one hand, we live in the information age with full digital access. Most of us have in our pocket a device that is more powerful than the original supercomputers, which took up whole floors of science buildings. This is more powerful than the biggest computers from the early age can do just about anything with this. We can cruise the information superhighway on the World Wide Web. We can access almost anything and anyone we want. We can see, hear, and listen and learn whatever, wherever. We can talk through things like Zoom, Skype, FaceTime, Google Hangout, WhatsApp chat with people anywhere in the world. We are incredibly interconnected. Even so, as we talked about last week, because of how media and social media act, as well as how we ourselves choose to interact with them, we tend to see less and less and less of that information and hear fewer and fewer of those voices. We ourselves make choices. We decide which magazine or newspaper to buy off the newsstand. We get the clicker out and decide which channel or channels to tune into and which online platforms to engage. But, and we'll talk about this in detail in just a moment, the algorithms of big data and big tech companies also choose what to show us once we get there. And as this slide suggests, our screens become more like mirrors than windows. They don't open us up to wider vistas. They sort of narrow us in, and in weird sort of ways.
They echo and they affirm with the thumbs up, like our heart, on our posts, if we already predisposed to believe. But let's start at the beginning of all this. Confession time. By show of hands, anyone regularly use any of the following social media? Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Vimeo, Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat, TikTok. Okay. So even though you and I are in the older, more mature demographic age-wise, even we, who didn't grow up with this. And I remember very vividly my second year of college, the first time I saw the internet. Even we are pretty digitally engaged. We're not entirely those goofy old men and women who say, things can be made, get off my lawn, and behaviors get better. We're online ourselves. And as you know, up in that, you know, when your children and grandchildren, the younger you get, the more online. Now, we ask them to confess how much time you spend on the platform, or who are not even checking the weekly screen time. But I will ask again, my fellow fans, how many of you use these platforms?
Battery might have died. Oh, yep. Oh.
Okay. Can he walk and chew gum at the same time? So I will hold the microphone. So how many of us use one or more of these digital social platforms as, if not the primary, a primary way of gathering information, news, opinion, what the heck's going on in Philadelphia with I-95 being on fire? Still a few of us, yeah. True. Again, we're probably below average, given that we're an older demographic. And again, the younger that demographic gets, the more extensive and at certain points more exclusive digital platforms are for the way that people engage content. Now, as we're about to see, how we use these platforms is as important as how much we use them. The Catholic media critic Marshall McLuhan told us a generation ago that the medium is the message. He says this is merely to say that the personal and social consequences of any medium, that is, any extension of ourselves, result from the new scale that is introduced by each extension of ourselves through any new technology. As the photograph on the slide illustrates, he was primarily thinking about broadcast television and the way it was emerging as the predominant media form in his time. Even so, McLuhan had envisioned something very much like what you and I call the internet almost 30 years before it came into existence. What do you think McLuhan means in saying the medium is the message?
not rhetorical. What does it mean to say the medium is the message? What's he on about? Yeah, go ahead.
I choose, as you said, I choose media that reinforce, that's almost like entertainment when it's called news. And it tends to reinforce what I believe. I sometimes force myself to watch the other point of view as long as I can.
Other thoughts? What does it mean to say the medium is the message? Hold on, we got to get the mic.
Choosing television, you're choosing that over newspapers or other possibilities. And so you're participating in something that's very passive, that's already determined ahead of time how it's supposed to affect us. We're just taking in. Is that what he was getting at?
I think that's some of it. So most of us have ordinary intuitions about the difference between watching something on a screen and reading something on paper or even on a tablet. You know, we talk about zoning out. You know, you're sort of like staring at the screen and not entirely fully engaged. Whereas when you're reading, you know, you're more actively engaged. That ordinary intuition is borne out by cognitive neuroscience. When they hook us up to little receptors that see which parts of our brains are going, smaller parts of our brains are going in visual media than print media, and different parts as well. So that basic intuition that watching news is a passive receptive activity, whereas reading is a more active and engaged activity, is right.
There was a fellow who turned the church on its head with a new mass communications technology, I think in the 16th century, Martin Luther.
Printing press. Good. Yeah. Yeah. So that's another good way to think about this. Of all the things that happened in and through those historical events that we now retrospectively refer to as the Protestant Reformation, one of the biggest ones was the effect that the printing press had in not only printing Bibles for mass consumption, still pretty restricted at that time by class, you had to have a bit of money to buy books, but along with printing and distributing, Luther was interested in translating. So not just the Latin Bible or the Greek New Testament, the Hebrew Tanakh, but the Vulgate, which is the snotty Latin way of saying the vernacular translation. So putting the holy text of scripture into whatever language or languages ordinary people would speak and read was a big part of that Reformation. And that medium, the printing press, revolutionize the ways in which Christians then and all of us now interact with our faith. I mean, I'm guessing most of us have 5 or 6 Bibles somewhere on the shelf at home. We probably have, you know, an app. I have an app on my phone, so, you know, I can pull up. That's a very different world than one in which only the priest or the pastor has the Bible. So the intuition McLuhan is giving voice to here is that content follows form. The way in which something is communicated transforms what is communicated. And for us, it's that telling phrase, the personal and social consequence of scale. As things get bigger, and as he puts it, when they get bigger, more of ourselves is extended. That matters most. Now, many times our engagement with this bigger, wider world made possible by digital media begins on a page that looks something like this, the search bar. In this case, Google, but it's the same for Bing and Yahoo. And unless you're really nerdy and use one of these offbeat browsers like Quant, it's the same dynamic, whichever platform you use. Now, whether we're looking for sports or television, politics, Hence, any inquiry begins with the search bar. And as you know, it tailors first for proximity. This is great if I'm looking for dinner or a gas station because my light just went bing on the dashboard and I'm low on fuel. I don't need to know what the best Mexican restaurant is in Los Angeles. I need to know what the best restaurant, Mexican restaurant is in Pittsburgh. So second, it tailors our returns in terms of our own search history. The internet remembers. It remembers everything. So if you were here 2 weeks ago looking for Mexican restaurants and you just type food near me, it's going to be like, oh, you like Mexican food. So I'm going to promote those restaurants to the top. So it's tailored to our history. In technical terms, that means it feeds our priors, our pre-existing commitments, at least as we've expressed them in our search history and browsing history. And that feeds into what sociologists and philosophers call confirmation bias, where we ask a question and get an answer that elicits the response from us, I knew it. I knew it. It tells us what we already think we know. Now, for things like shopping and restaurants, for gas stations and parking spaces, that's all good. You know, those tailorings actually serve our needs pretty well. But if we're looking for things like medical advice, news, then those biases become more troubling. It becomes more troubling still because the hits that are reported on searches are tailored by which advertisers and organizations pay. Now, fortunately, Google over the last few years has now included a little good housekeeping label that says this is a promoted advertisement. This isn't just naturally what came up first based on ordinary factors. It's that Taco Bell paid to be the first list, the first hit in the Mexican restaurant list, or Chipotle paid to be the first list, or some local Tres Cantinas family. So it is jiggered, in a certain sense, rigged based on who's paying for what. Now, Google does you the courtesy, as do most search engines, of telling you which hits are promoted, who's paying to put the thumb on the scale. Facebook, for the most part, does not. It just throws something up as if it's the natural result of, you know, hey, what's out there, what's close. And this is particularly controversial in our recent political elections, because people are looking for information and they think they're getting sort of a fair, even-handed report. But in the background, Facebook is playing with the numbers and playing with them in terms of who's paying, Democrats, Republicans, this candidate, or that. Now, promoted advertisements might be tolerable for things like consumer goods, but for things like news, I don't think that's in our best interest. And last but not least, your search bar will tailor your responses for engagement. It serves up what most likely will get you to click through to the next page, to stay on that page, to scroll up and down and read, to see whoever has put advertisements in the sidebar, and so on and so forth. We remarked last week that if the motto of legacy media is, if it bleeds, it leads, the motto of new media is, if it screams, it streams. Because the platinum standard of the magical and mysterious algorithm is attention. You may have seen a car like this at some point on the highway and noticed that among its many bumper stickers is this one. If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. What does that bumper sticker mean? And Ted, if you could do your Phil Donahue roving mic, that would be fantastic. If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. What is
Who's Phil Donahue?
Come on, we're all old enough to remember Donahue. I won't ask you to do the Neil presentation, but.
Well, if you watch both sides of the political, we'll talk politics for a minute. If you're watching both sides, you have a view of how bad it is.
Sure.
And that means you're paying attention. Mm-hmm. And if you watch only what reinforces your own views, you wouldn't know that particularly.
Okay. What else does this cheeky bumper sticker mean?
Well, reading into what the other stickers on the car.
Good. Use the context clues. Well done.
Obviously, they're saying that if you're not outraged with me, you know, on my side,
okay, good,
then you're not paying attention.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Looking at the other bumper stickers, does it mean that it's nice to be outraged?
Maybe.
Or kind?
Maybe. I hadn't done a full exegesis of all the bumper stickers. I just was looking for a handy image that had the one I wanted. So the most basic sense of this bumper sticker, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention, I think is saying, if you are paying attention, if you're looking at our world through whatever lens or lenses the other bumper stickers might suggest to us, that if you really see what's going on, you should be pretty concerned. So the sense of the bumper sticker is that if you pay attention and look what's happening over here in this little corner of the world, genocide. If you're looking over here in this other corner of the world, economic exploitation. So the sense of the bumper sticker is that if one pays attention, the proper moral response is outrage. Because when you see all the stuff, to put it politely, that's going on, you should be mad about it because it's not right. Ted, could you bring the microphone up?
When I was in college, I took a course in philosophy, and what it was about was finding the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is searching for the truth, does that have any meaning anymore?
Sure.
Is that a fair question?
That is a fair question. The short answer is yes, it does. We could do a whole nother Westminster seminar series on what truths and facts mean. We'll talk
we'll put you on the schedule for that.
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that in the fall. Put a pin in that for a moment. We'll circle back in a little bit when we talk about fake news and post-truth world, but that's an important question. So the sense of the bumper sticker is if one pays attention, the natural, normal, and appropriate reaction is outrage. Because when you pay attention, you see there's all kinds of bad things going on. And it's right and good and proper to be upset about it because people are being treated badly because this terrible thing is going on. With the advent of big data in both traditional media and social media, I think there's a different sense of the bumper sticker that we need to pay attention to. The wager behind data-driven media production, whether it's the evening news on fill-in-the-blank network, the front page on fill-in-the-blank newspaper, or the top feed on fill-in-the-blank social media platform. The new sense of the bumper sticker, the one that I think is most concerning in terms of these dynamics of polarization and negative partisanship, is unless we're outraged, we don't pay attention. So that it's not that outrage follows from attention, as in the original sense of the bumper sticker, look around, see bad stuff, be mad about it. It's rather, I'm going to make you mad, so you do pay attention. So the algorithms are rigged for engagement. More eyes, more views, more clicks equals more
engagement,
which equals more dollars. So this is all an economic model.
Just one, what you were saying will make you outraged so that you do pay attention to us.
Yep. Yeah, whoever us is. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the new and troubling sense of our, what some people call attention economy, you know, what makes money is not, you know, primarily cars on trucks, cereal on shelves, it's attention. And the way that these people get our attention across all media platforms, old and new, is by upsetting us. So in this sense of the bumper sticker, if we're not outraged, we won't be paying as much attention.
But that's not really anything new in human behavior.
Sure.
You know, little kids scream and cry to get attention until they learn that's not the best way to do it. So why are we why is the world regressing in a sense? That's what it seems to me.
Yeah.
And I'll just mention that the turn of the 20th century, there was a phenomenon that was labeled yellow journalism that operated mm-hmm. off precisely that mm-hmm. principle.
Yeah. So yellow journalism, jingoism, the whole bit. Yeah, so this
muckraking.
Muckraking. This is nothing new under the sun, but think back to that Marshall McLuhan quote, not the coat, the quote. It's the scale. Once upon a time at 7 p.m. or 9 p.m., what happened to your television? Test pattern. It's done. There's literally nothing more for you to see. But now it's not just a 24/7 news cycle. It's a second by second by second by second by second by second attention cycle. So it's that same baseline human behavior.
Look at me.
But hyper accelerated through these digital media. So it's an ordinary pre-existing human relational and social behavior now conscripted and accelerated through the pace of a digital world. So yeah, the single best way to grab our attention is through negative emotion, through engaging that same negative partisanship that I feel at a Duke Carolina basketball game, but instead making it how I feel not about a sports team in a really small, constricted part of my life, but how I feel about my neighbor. Those people over there, across town, across the state, across the country, across the world. Negative emotion, anger, disgust, contempt, and outrage. So that's the medium that shapes the messages that we're giving and receiving, sending and receiving in our digital age. So the algorithm knows who we are and what we want. It pays particular attention to what we don't like, you know, negative emotion. And it's not so much a map that shows us what's out there, although it does do that. It helps us get things faster, easier, cheaper. It's also a massive filter and a very restrictive funnel that screens out views that we tend not to like, information with which we disagree, and puts on our screens what we prefer and affirm. It figures out which side of that aisle we lean towards, and then it presents us views from the other side only in negative context. The internet doesn't say, hey, what if you think about it this way? It says, hey, look what those morons think over there. Aren't they stupid? Aren't they bad? And we put our little thumbs up on the posts, we share it, and we pass it on. And all of this means that the internet, and not just the internet, newspapers do similar work behind the scenes, broadcast journalism does similar work behind the scenes. All these things are not just predictive, they're prescriptive. They shape us. All of this was captured in a Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma. Has anybody watched this? A couple of you, if you've not, you know, you should.
The Social Dilemma goes behind the scenes and interviews people inside of Google, Apple, Facebook, Twitter, and sort of gets them to tell on their bosses to say, yeah, what we were doing is trying to make you think, feel, buy this.
But a lot of those interviews were of people that were in high positions and left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got out.
They were disgusted with what they saw.
Yeah. So it's people who got in early, rose quickly because of their technical prowess, and then became dissatisfied with the ways in which the technology was being used. But as the documentary reveals, the algorithms and the companies who run them are not just pulling up a search string that answers our questions. They're pulling our strings like a marionette and shaping what it even occurs to us to ask. So taken together, what we ourselves want from these platforms and what they want from us converge in a perfect but perverse synergy. Because what we want, whether we like it or not, and what they want is that emotional response, that attention economy. Now, sometimes the attention economy and emotional response is the cute cat part of the internet. Aw, look at that. It's a kitty in a pant leg. And then we want to see the next kitty in the cute setup. It gives us the warm fuzzies. However, as we've said, on the other hand, and on the opposite end of the spectrum, the internet is overrun by outrage content. We are fed steady streams and a consistent diet, whether we're on the right or the left, that pulls us towards inflammatory controversy. We're pushed by incendiary images like these. So it's not the warm fuzzies of cute kittens. It's hot fury. It's not, aw. It's, oh, hell no. Consider this. Computer scientists have run multiple tests and experiments with various iterations of machine learning. Machine learning is the technology behind algorithms and search engines, the predictive and prescriptive shaping of the message that's shaped by the medium. In 2012, Google set up an artificial brain with 10 million random screenshots of YouTube content. The Google brain analyzed that content for patterns. What comes up most often? What gets the most clicks? And without any explicit instruction from the Google engineers, it fixated on cat content. And it decided that that was the best content to put out in terms of engagement. So the program on its own, just looking at patterns of clicking, liking, loving, sharing, reposting, et cetera, figured out without even knowing what a cat was, that content sells. In 2016, Microsoft set up an AI chatbot named Tay that was a composite of teenage girl profiles. They gave Tay a Twitter account, and as the program ran, Tay accumulated nearly 50,000 followers and generated almost 100,000 tweets. Within hours of that algorithmic artificial intelligence Twitter account running, through aggregation and interaction, it figured out that the most retweetable content was outrage. And it started posting things like hashtag race war now. Bush did 9/11. So again, looking only for engagement metrics, these engines gravitate to those two emotional poles, all cute cats and, you know, outrage. And of course, more recently, ChatGPT is now on the scene. What's ChatGPT? Let's just do a quick current digital media quiz.
Well, it's based on an enormous amount of machine learning, mm-hmm. and it can write college essays. I mean, there's it apparently it's the first time that a computer system can create what seems like human writing, human content.
Exactly right. So there's something called the Turing test, not like Tour de France, but T-U-R-I-N-G after a British computer scientist. And the Turing test is whether or not an AI interface can fool a human user into thinking that they're human. ChatGPT is as close as we've gotten. You can go online and register for a free account and feed it basic prompts, and it will generate content. As he just said, it will write your college essay for you, which scares teachers like me. Because I used to have to only worry if you were copying from your neighbor. Right now I have to worry if, an AI bot is writing your content. So yesterday, as I was getting ready for today, I asked ChatGPT about polarization. And without anything other than saying, what is polarization, it told me, polarization has become an increasingly prevalent and concerning aspect of modern societies. It refers to the division of people into distinct and often opposing ideological groups, resulting in a deepening divide and a breakdown of constructive dialogue. Identity polarization, stacking, and negative partisanship are interconnected and mutually reinforcing. As people identify more strongly with their political beliefs, they seek out like-minded individuals and information sources that confirm their biases. This further deepens their negative perceptions of the opposing side, perpetuating the cycle of polarization. The consequences of this polarization are far-reaching, including the erosion of social cohesion, decreased trust in institutions, and the hindrance of effective governance. Yeah. I shouldn't have told you that, because now all you need to do is get ChatGPT to write you a couple of speeches and build you a couple slides.
Did you do that before or after you wrote your presentation for this week?
I did it sort of in the middle, because I got to the two earlier examples of AI, the Google Brain and the Twitter account. And then I was like, ChatGPT, that's a new example.
I have a question. So we're addicted to AI, and you're going to tell us how to overcome this addiction at some point?
I don't know about overcome. Unless you're someone who's inclined to opt for a radical lifestyle change and, you're going to go off the grid and unplug, I think these things are here to stay. There are going to be parts of our lives going forward, and the questions are, what are the legal, moral, and social constraints that will make them mostly helpful and additive contributions to our individual and shared social life? And how do we kind of put the brakes on the downside?
Well, now I'm worried about college professors coming to our church and writing their presentations through AI. So we're even.
What all this reveals is that the algorithms that run certain engines and social media platforms, the same algorithms that run viewer engagement analyses for television and newspapers, the real difference between legacy media, newspapers, television, magazines, and social media is whether the algorithm is running in real time, which it is on social media, or is running before and after production, as it is with traditional television and print media. Either way, the people deciding about the content, deciding about the message, are doing the numbers to figure out how to keep the smiles on the register. So these algorithms look for what's trending, what's hot. Last week, I-95 Uncle Dougie was hot, literally because we want to buy our, crap. They look for notoriety, so one of them. Celebrities, big accounts share. So people like the Kardashians and outside of Google now are public because they have no one's public. Again, we're looking at that engagement and seeing how engagement is driven by the negative emotion. And this goes to your point, once you circle back. For the most part, the algorithm is not testing for truthfulness or bad knowledge. Now, in the last 5-ish years, due to user response and public outrage and good sense, different media platforms have started to tweak the algorithm. Google and other search engines have long given you the courtesy of the promoted movement. Zuckerberg and Facebook have been a little cagier and more reluctant about letting regulators know what's going on in their algorithm, and letting users know how much content is driven by outside influence advertising money, and how much is driven by, well, these are the 96,000 things you put on the last 3 years, so it's not like that. Twitter was moving towards a more responsible messaging system, and then Elon Musk bought it, so now it's entirely wildly not updated, and so it's subject to different restrictions. But the trick is, for the most part, if they are sending the truth and fact, that keyword would be in the selection writer. It's back to your question. There's an old saying, usually attributed to the first one, that says, a lie is flattery in the world because the truth has a chance to be. The sentiment, whether it was searching for somebody else who actually said it, is that it's part of the grand misperception or deception after it's happened than it is to get the correct, truthful, actual thing out of the person. Now, we might say in part, a lie that's around the world wide web of the past before the truth had advanced the world. So, again, it's not that the world is different in the sense of people being different, we're still the same creatures that we've always been. But the speed at which information travels and the ways in which it travels makes those basic, unchanging human relational dynamics a lot different than they are, primarily face-to-face. It's that media message, particularly that aspect of the scale. That makes sense? So now we need to sort of take a moment to quickly step back and ask, if this is what scholars do, largely the scale and speed at which negative information, negative emotion are traveling in the world, what do we do? And theologically, we need to do all kinds of sophisticated work. We'll do a little bit more next week, but I think most basically, what we're talking about is being good neighbors, both in the ordinary sense, being decent people across the street, and in the extraordinary sense, for me. As Bill Warren said, that love and everything. So how do you respond? One of the ways we think about this is my
drink. I don't know. that is the door now. All right. So Martin Luther, who made a cameo appearance earlier in the discussion, talks about sin as being incurvatus in se, which is the Latin way of saying curved in on oneself. So the idea is that with sin, we turn away from God, we turn in on ourselves, and as a consequence, we turn against each other. Now, I doubt that the cartoonist who drew this New Yorker cover illustration had Martin Luther and incurvatus in se in mind. Nevertheless, I think the illustration of the hipster hunched over on his cell phone is a vivid depiction of the ways in which this dynamic of sin, turning in on oneself, turning away from God and neighbor, is, again, accelerated by walking around with these little doodads in our pocket. Online in the supermarket, I'm more likely to check the score of the ball game than to chat up the person in line behind me. Just one small way this changes how we act and interact. Now, from this understanding, we can begin to respond to our one more time. Get this on here right. We can begin to respond to the ways we use and perhaps even abuse social media. In some ways, as cognitive neuroscientists tell us, turning to social media is literally a way to get a little dopamine hit in the back of our brains. As the information scientist Edward Tuff puts it, there are only two industries that call their customers users: drug dealers and tech companies. That little accident of language, I think, tells us quite a lot. But from a theological perspective, we can think of things like Romans 12, which tells us to not be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Or Corinthians, to take every thought, every tweet, every post, every share captive. So if that's our theological perspective, to love our neighbor, to not be captivated by the thinking around us, to take thoughts captive, what can we do? We can unplug. We can delete, disconnect, and silence. In another part of my academic work, I do a lot of comparative work with Jewish theologians, philosophers, and ethicists. And many of them are devout observers of Sabbath. So from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday, their phones are off in a drawer. Their televisions are off. They turn their attention to God and neighbor and family. It's a compelling practice that I wish I had more wherewithal to integrate into my own life. So there are ways in which we can, at least once a week maybe, take a step back from all the noise and the chatter and the outrage that comes with it. I think one of the biggest ones is to curate rather than capitulate to the algorithm. So my primary social medium, which is not surprising for my age demographic, is Twitter. And one way to interact with Twitter is to just let the algorithm feed you whatever the heck it thinks you want. Another way is to create what they call lists. And lists are, I pick who I want to listen to. And so rather than what the algorithm says, it's, you know, I have one that's friends and family. I have one for basketball. I have one for auto racing. I have others. And so rather than letting the algorithm decide what's coming through, I exercise a measure of control. And I think you said a moment ago, you watch other broadcast news. I have two or three lists that feed me opinion, commentary, and reporting from sources and perspectives that I don't identify as my own. And it's a discipline to try to listen charitably, to read, to take seriously that other viewpoint. We can do the same thing with broadcasts, with newspapers, so on and so forth. So I think that's one big way to decelerate polarization, is to get to know people who think differently, even if only through news. I think this also bears on that question about truth. By collecting and collating and coordinating multiple viewpoints, I think that's one way we get closer to something like objective perspective, small o, because the biases and the investments and the interests offset each other. We're at time, but just let me think real quick or finish real quick. Again, unfollow, use lists and other aggregators. There's a website called realclearpolitics.com, which is a nice place to start because it does this for you. It's a website that produces some of its own commentary and opinion, but it mostly just aggregates and collates from across the ideological spectrum news and opinion. So if there's a presidential debate, you go there the next morning and it will give you left, right, center. Here's what happened. Here's how it went. It's a good first step to try to get out of the echo chamber, get out of the bubble. In short and in technical terms, what we want to do is renew our minds and take those thoughts captive. And in so doing, put a little bit, at least, of a brake on polarization to stop feeding or let the outrage machine feed us and to engage more thoughtfully and carefully. It's 10:46. I'm happy to stay a few minutes more if people have questions, but if you know, the bell has rung. So if you have another class in third period, you are welcome to go. But if you'd like to linger and chat a bit, I'm happy to do that. That went a little bit longer than I thought.